Tanya 200. We're up to chapter 23 in the Tanya. And to bring the subject up to date, in chapter 22, the Rebbe explains how idolatry does not mean a denial of God's existence. Idolatry means the denial of God's oneness. And what is the oneness of God? The oneness of God means that all reality and all existence is God, and there is nothing besides Him. And that's because, in truth, all of creation exists within God, never outside of God. Nothing in creation has a will of its own or an agenda of its own. It exists only as a result of God's will, because it serves God's will. Only in God's will there are two parts. There are those things that God wants for their own sake, because this appeals to Him essentially, intrinsically, and that's the holiness and the godliness in the world, the godly things. And then there are those things that God wants, but not from His inner self, not as an end in itself, but only as a means to an end. And that we call the ungodly or the evil. The evil in the world serves a purpose. And so God wants the evil, which is why He creates the evil, but He doesn't want it the same way that He wants the godly, the good, because the good is an end in itself, whereas the evil is only a tool and a means to an end. And of course the end being the enhancement of the good. So the oneness of God is expressed and seen in the fact that everything in nature obeys God's will. Nature itself is an obedience to God's will. God said, and there was. God said, let there be light, and there was light. This is obedience, which means that light has no will of its own, no agenda of its own. It has no purpose of its own, and therefore exists solely, exclusively, by virtue of God's will and God's interest and God's agenda and God's purpose. This unholy stuff that God creates as a means to an end does not recognize its creator, does not recognize the exclusivity of its creator, because it considers itself significant, maybe not as significant as God, but also significant. So although the unholy, even the idolaters, even the idol itself, the unholiness of the idol, does not deny God's existence, in fact, it doesn't deny its dependence on God. And the early idolaters referred to God as the God of gods, which means that without God, nothing could happen, nothing would happen, nothing would exist. They recognize that and they believe that. But they also believe that once created, the created being, or themselves, have taken on an existence and a being that is independent of God. So idolatry means I exist separate from God, not within God, not as part of God, not in response to God, but with my own agenda. And my own agenda could contradict God's agenda. But even when it doesn't, even if I'm behaving well, even if I'm not violating God's will, I am violating God's oneness in the very fact that I consider myself a separate entity, which in very simple words means God wants me to be good, but then I have to decide what I want. Which means that my will, although not as awesome as God's will, is significant enough to warrant separate consideration and separate attention. So I know what God wants, now I have to decide what I want. And I'm not going to be so foolish as to say that my will is as important as God's will. It's obviously not. But important enough to deserve separate consideration. So God says, be good, and I'm thinking about it. I'm giving it consideration. I'm trying to decide whether it fits with my agenda, whether it suits my purpose, whether it furthers my cause, as if my agenda and purpose and cause are significant in any way in a world in which the only reality is God's. Since the whole world exists only by virtue of God's purpose and God's desire in creation. So for me to think that I have another purpose, a lesser purpose, but still other purpose, is inappropriate and out of place, like a guest in someone's house who knows that the house doesn't belong to them, but still they have certain plans and certain needs and agendas concerning the behavior and the conduct of the house, which is highly inappropriate for a guest. Now in chapter 23, the Rebbe explains how through every mitzvah we are confirming and deepening the oneness of God. Oneness of God meaning that we exist only within God's plan, as part of God's plan, as the expression, the quote, I was created only to serve my Creator. I have no other agenda. How does every mitzvah that we fulfill further the oneness of God? It works something like this. Every commandment, every positive commandment, keeping Shabbos, keeping kosher, giving charity, lighting the Shabbos candles, every one of them is essential in God's will. These are the things God wants for themselves as an end in themselves. This appeals to God essentially. This is godliness. It is for these things that God created the world in the first place, which means that all of existence is due to God's desire for the mitzvah. Because when God decided to create the world, when God said, let there be light, what was the inner motivation? What was the truest motivation within God for creating the world? So that the godliness could be practiced, so that the mitzvah would be observed. So the mitzvah represents God's inner will, God's personal will, an end in itself. When the person does the mitzvah, a number of things happen. First of all, the body, the vehicle through which the mitzvah is performed, the hand that gives the charity, the mouth that says the blessing or the prayer, the feet that go to do the mitzvah, and so on, the body itself, the limbs of the body, merge with God's will to such a degree that it is called the divine chariot. So in the vision of Yechezkel, of Ezekiel, where he sees a chariot with the divine throne on the chariot, that chariot is the body of the person performing the mitzvah. And that's why the Zohar says that all the commandments are like limbs of the body. In the Zohar it means like limbs of God's body, so to speak. But here the Rebbe takes it to mean also the effect that it has on the limbs of the body performing the mitzvah. When a person performs the mitzvah, he becomes connected to God in a number of ways. The limb of the body itself becomes connected to God like a chariot is responsive to its rider. The chariot has no will of its own. It goes where the rider wants it to go. And so is the body of the person fulfilling the mitzvah. The will of God is motivating the action, the movement, and so the limb performing the mitzvah has become the chariot or the vehicle for God's inner will, true will. What is the devotion, the oneness of a chariot with its rider? The oneness consists of the fact that the chariot has no agenda or will of its own. However, when the chariot responds to the rider has to do something to cause the chariot to move. It doesn't happen automatically. There's an effort necessary. And so we see that the chariot and the rider, although the chariot is completely obedient to the rider, but the rider has to overcome the distance and the difference between himself and his chariot and do something to cause the chariot to go or to take the direction that the rider wants. There's another level or degree of oneness, of harmony, and that's represented by the limbs of the body in their obedience to the soul. When the soul wants to move, the limbs of the body move automatically, instantly, and without effort. In fact, sometimes we find that we moved without even knowing that we did it. Like in a time of danger, for example, where a person instinctively moves and avoids the danger and only later realizes what he did. So it was not a purposeful and necessary decision or instruction or effort on the part of the soul to get the foot to move, for example. When the soul wants to move, the foot moves immediately, effortlessly. The soul doesn't have to make any effort to get the foot to move and doesn't have to do anything special. All it needs is to want, and the foot responds. And that's because the limbs of the body are much more sensitive to the soul than a chariot is to a rider. So there's a greater degree of oneness there. Now, the faculty, the power of speech, the power of action that a person uses in performing the mitzvah, not the limb, but the ability, the faculty, not the lips that speak, but the power of speech, is much closer to godliness because it's less physical. And therefore, when the person speaks words of Torah, when the person speaks words of prayer and does the act of the mitzvah, the power of the faculty, the action and the speech, they become connected to God more than a chariot is connected to its rider. They become connected to God like a limb is connected to a soul. And that's why the Zohar says that the commandments are like limbs of God. Because the oneness that results from doing a mitzvah is that the inner will of God is present in the faculty of speech and in the faculty of action. When the person says or does a mitzvah, in such a, it is so revealed and it is so felt that the faculty becomes one with God like a limb is one with its soul. And even that is not the greatest or highest level of oneness. We usually speak about the virtue, the greatness of the act of a mitzvah. What is the greatness of the act of a mitzvah? When you do a mitzvah, you are fulfilling God's will. And the fulfillment of God's will is the most meaningful and the most significant part of all of creation. God has a will, he has a purpose and a plan, and when you fulfill that purpose and that plan, that gives God the ultimate satisfaction and the ultimate pleasure that his will is fulfilled. Even in human relationships, there is nothing more satisfying than providing a person's need or a person's will. That is the most meaningful, the most personal connection, is to have your will fulfilled or your need fulfilled. But here we're talking about oneness rather than fulfillment and purpose. In the oneness with God, the study of Torah is greater than the performance of the mitzvah. You have to make a distinction here. God wants a Jew to put on tefillin. God wants every human being to honor their parents. Now, the will of God that we honor our parents, and our response to that will, where we go ahead and honor our parents in action and in speech, are ultimately two separate things. God wants the honor, we are doing the honor. So although the doing is the most appropriate response and the most deeply satisfying response to God's will, but when we are fulfilling His will, when we are responding to His will, we are not completely one with Him. We are serving Him. And this is the way He wants to be served. He wants to be served by someone who is not Him, who has freedom of choice, who decides and chooses to obey God's will. That's what gives God the satisfaction of the fulfillment of the mitzvah. But when a person is doing the mitzvah, and God wants the mitzvah, there are two things going on here. It's not all one. On the other hand, when a person says the words of Torah, he reads the words, he reads the Ten Commandments, and he reads, "Thou shalt honor your father and mother." There is nothing here besides God Himself. These are God's words, and you are saying the same words. There aren't two things going on, like in the fulfillment of the mitzvah, where God said and you do. Here you have a complete oneness. There is only God's will that you are thinking and saying when you study Torah. So in terms of the oneness of God, there is a greater oneness when we study the Torah than when we do the mitzvah. Again, in doing the mitzvah, there's a greater fulfillment and satisfaction in God because His will is done and His need is fulfilled. But in terms of oneness, in terms of connectedness, in the study of Torah, we merge with God more than in the fulfillment of the mitzvah, which means that we are reflecting God's oneness more completely and more totally when we immerse ourselves in the study of Torah rather than in the act of the mitzvah. This is what makes the study of Torah unique and great among all mitzvahs. The patriarchs, we are told, embodied, personified the chariot of God. In what way? When any person fulfills a mitzvah, does the mitzvah, fulfills the commandment, the limbs of the body engaged in the fulfillment of that mitzvah become the chariot for God for the duration of the mitzvah. In other words, in the act, for as long as the act takes, for that moment, for that time, the limbs of the body are the chariot of godliness. What was unique about the patriarchs? Why are they described as the chariot? Because every moment of their existence, every moment of their lives, not only when they were doing a mitzvah, but all the time, the limbs of their body were completely and totally devoted to the service of God and had no agenda of its own. So they're unique in that the limbs of their body were always a vehicle, a chariot. With us, in the fulfillment of the mitzvah, the limbs of the body become a vehicle. More than that, the faculty that is expressed in the limbs of the body, whether it's speech or action, they become more than a vehicle for godliness. They become the limbs of God. That God's will is expressed and felt in the faculties of the person doing the mitzvah, like the soul is felt and experienced in the limbs of the body. And what is special about that? That the limbs of the body don't need special instruction or any special action to get them to do what they need to do. They respond instantly, effortlessly, to the will of the soul. What happens when a person studies Torah? Here, the Zohar says, God and Torah are all one. Not like a chariot devoted to its rider, not even like a limb responsive to the soul, but much more than both, they are one and the same. When the person studies Torah, he is one with God, not only like a responsive limb that hears or senses the will of the soul, but more than that, they're actually one and the same. And that's because in the study of Torah, you are immersed in God's will without a need for any action or for any response at all. You're there. That's it. There is nothing else going on besides God's will. Because God said you should honor your parents, God said you should keep Shabbos, and you're saying exactly the same thing. So there's no otherness. There's only God himself. And that degree of oneness, the Rebbe says, doesn't exist anywhere in the higher worlds or in the heavens. Because in the higher worlds, all of them were created because of Torah or by Torah, out of Torah. As it says, all was created by wisdom. Kulam b'chokhma asisa. You created everything out of wisdom. Wisdom is the Torah. So all of creation comes from Torah. But the godliness of Torah is much higher and greater than the created worlds, even the heavens that God created. Which means that the godly presence in Torah is greater than the capacity that creation has, the ability that it has to absorb that kind of godliness. And that's why the godliness that we're talking about, God's inner will, can only surround the world, but can't be contained by the world. So creation cannot contain God's inner will. The inner will is what causes creation, but it's much bigger than the creation, can't be contained within it. Where is God's inner will present? In the Torah. So when a person studies Torah, he comes into contact with a complete oneness. He merges totally with that will of God, with that godliness, that nature and creation, even the highest worlds and the highest heavens, cannot contain. And here the person is merging with that very godliness that is too big for creation. The awe that gives us, the Rebbe says, should be very helpful in moving us to serve God with our heart. Because there's a statement in a verse in Torah that says, the commandments were given so that you will fear God. Which needs explanation, because why would you fulfill the commandment if you don't already fear God? In other words, the fear of God is necessary to motivate you to fulfill the commandment. So what does it mean that the commandment is there to bring fear of God? If you don't already fear God, you're not going to do the commandment. So we see that there is a fear of God necessary to motivate us to do the mitzvah, to do the commandment, to obey. But then the commandment itself brings us to a much higher fear of God. I might put it this way. There is the basic fear of God that we have that consists of the fear of losing touch. We don't want to be separated. We don't want to be severed from God. That fear motivates us to do the commandment. So what is the fear? A fear of separation. A fear of alienation. We don't want to be severed. Once we do the commandment, we move up to a much higher level where we fear God, not because we might be separated or severed from God, but because we are in awe of the degree of godliness that we have just contacted. Because it is greater than the godliness that nature can contain. So it's more of an awe than a fear of loss. So this greater degree of fear comes as a result of the commandment, of fulfilling the commandment, and it is the purpose, the end result of the fulfillment. So we keep the mitzvah in order to experience that greater fear, that awe that comes after the doing. The same thing is true with oneness and with God. When we're about to do a mitzvah, there's a certain oneness that we feel that motivates us to do the mitzvah. That's the wisdom that comes before the doing. But then the doing itself, in the case of the study of Torah, moves us up to a higher level of oneness, to a greater degree of oneness, to where we are one with that part of God that the world cannot contain. So these are the degrees of oneness that godliness produces. In the act of the mitzvah, the limb becomes the vehicle, the faculty becomes like a limb of God, and in the study of Torah, they become actually one with God. That's the oneness of God, that our love for God, which we inherit, which we have in the inner recesses of the heart, seeks and desires and therefore motivates us to do the mitzvah. And in the next chapter, we'll see how the flip side, how every sin represents severing ourselves from God and therefore totally incompatible with our soul.